Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, I'm joined by three UK think tank experts, Will Tanner, Director of Onward, Caris Roberts, Executive Director of IPPBR, and Nick Bowes, Chief Executive of Centre for London, to get their views on the levelling up debate in advance of the much anticipated levelling up white paper. My first guest is Will Tanner.
Will is the director of Onward, a centre-right think tank. He's also the former special advisor to Theresa May and deputy head of the policy unit in Number 10 Downing Street when she was there as PM. Welcome, Will.
Hi, Andrew. Very good to be here.
So we're going to have a chat about the much anticipated and hopefully imminent levelling up white paper. And so I should say we're recording this in mid-October, and we're assuming, although you may tell you something different, we're assuming that the white paper is out at some point towards the end of October, maybe to coincide with the budget and the spending review. So for listeners, bear that in mind. Things that we say may undoubtedly be wrong, but maybe they were right when we said them. So I think the first thing, probably, well, you know, in a sense, it is only since December 19 that we've been talking about levelling up. In a sense, you know, new government came in with that very much as the agenda. Feels an awful lot longer that we've been talking about this. I mean, it's everywhere, it's every day, it's everything. But I mean, taking a step back, what's your sort of view on and reflections on, you know, the nature of the debate, how it's evolved, and I suppose, you know, where we are right now? And then I'd be interested in your take. You know, both of us were at party conferences over the last couple of weeks or so. Just your views on, you know, how that kind of played out, particularly the Conservatives. But, you know, just where do you think we are in terms of the levelling up debate? How has it evolved over the last 18 months or so?
Well, I think it's definitely true that people have been talking about fixing the UK's kind of regional divergence problem for some time. You've had academics like Philip McCann, you've had politicians like Tony Blair, George Osborne, Jim O'Neill, kind of putting this at the kind of heart of the policy debate. But I think it's also fair to say that it's only really in the last 4 or 5 years where this has become a really mainstream concern for the Conservative Party in particular, and for the kind of centre of British politics in particular. So so when I was in Downing Street under Theresa May, we were consciously attempting to kind of forge a slightly more egalitarian path in policy and caring about people and places which had been perhaps neglected or forgotten within the kind of policy debate for a while. And then in the last few years with the levelling up agenda, I think that's taken on an even stronger dimension where, partly because the 2019 election and the kind of realignment of the British electorate, but the Conservative Party just now has a vested interest in caring about a load of places now that it never did before. And therefore levelling up has gone from, I think, being a kind of aspiration and a kind of good thing to do to being a political necessity for the political class, and particularly for this Prime Minister in the kind of post-Brexit environment. And so levelling up has gone from, I think, being part of the debate to actually being probably the central driving force behind domestic policy today. And that for me is very exciting. I think long overdue that the Conservative Party cares about kind of post-industrial towns in the north of England. And it creates quite an interesting dynamic politically where I think the Conservative Party is going to have to do some policy thinking of a kind that it perhaps hasn't done in the kind of past. So it creates quite an interesting burning platform for new policy development.
Yeah, and I mean, I've heard you kind of talk about this before, and it's been struck every time you've said it. It's the, you know, your point about it's the political grip of the, you know, that really is a kind of difference, rather than maybe before it was a policy orientated ambition, you know, because we want the best for the country, etc. And obviously they still do want that, but there's a real political rationale and reason for taking this kind of thing seriously.
Yeah, I think that's right. So just to give some statistics that I think really bear this out, and you've heard me say some of these things before, Andrew, but before the 2019 election, the centre point of conservatism, the midpoint geographically of conservative MPs, was in Buckinghamshire. After the 2019 election, that midpoint was in Sheffield. Like, if you want a clearer indication of the shift within the Conservative Party over the last few years, that is it. I think there are other indicators too. So there's the fact that the Conservative Party is now the party of the working class statistically, the fact that if you look at the average earnings of seats won by the Conservative Party in the 2019 election, average earnings are actually 5% lower than Labour seats. So you've had a kind of big shift where the Conservative Party actually now represents the poorest constituencies on average in the UK of any party. So all of those kind of dynamics, I think, create this kind of political necessity for the party to embrace radical policy. And I think it also means that the kind of battleground of the next election, I mean, there was lots of talk about the blue wall, but inevitably it's going to be the red wall again, because those are all quite marginal seats, including a load of seats actually the Conservative parties could win, having not succeeded in winning them in 2019. I mean, half of the red wall is still standing, right? So the battleground is again going to be up in the north and the Midlands. So I think it just creates a really interesting political dynamic that kind of makes it essential for the Conservatives to follow through.
And do you see a difference between the sort of newer red wall, blue wall MPs, a kind of difference between them and what they expect or what they want from a Conservative government compared to maybe some of the more, traditional Conservative MPs that would be more typically in the, in the heartland of where the Conservatives have always drawn their vote? Is there a coalition that is quite distinct or not? What's your view on that?
It's a really interesting question. I'm going to slightly fudge my answer by saying yes and no. So I think there are differences between the new Conservative kind of parliamentary vote, the new MPs elected in 2019, and some of the older generations of Conservative MPs. Some of that is just actually, frankly, pragmatism versus ideology. So the new MPs tend to be much more pragmatic about the role of the state, much less kind of ideological about markets and kind of ever diminishing state and low taxes, are much more willing to see the state kind of intervene to support prosperity in their place and support earnings for their constituents. I think, however, it's very easy to overstate the difference between the North and South of the Conservative Party, or between different parts of the Conservative Party. If you look at the electorate, actually the values of the Conservative Party's new voters in the North and the Midlands and the kind of working to man archetype that we came up with at the last election is very, very similar to the kind of core Conservative vote that has always voted Conservative in the kind of southern heartlands. And actually that's the reason why the red wall became a thing, because it was a load of places which statistically, on the basis of demographic markers, should vote Conservative, but because of some kind of cultural or hygiene factor, didn't. And when James Calegazzorian was identifying the red wall, it was a statistical artifact rather than anything else. So actually there's a lot of similarity. And actually I think the real challenge for the Labour Party is they're up against a kind of Conservative electorate now that is pretty homogenous around the country, whereas the Labour electorate is very divided between a metropolitan vote and an old class vote.
Yeah.
That makes it really hard for them to unite a centre ground coalition.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I mean, I've been struck by Labour's reluctance or uncertainty about how to proceed on these kinds of issues. Ironically, even when the public expect them to have positions well thought out on these issues, they would expect them to have a real understanding of what levelling up is and what the Labour Party would do. I think they're a bit reluctant to engage in that sort of space. You and I were at Conservative Party conference not so long ago, a week or so ago. What was your take? I mean, as far as I could see, practically every event that was advertised that I went to had something and levelling up in the title, and then every speech said, and this is an example of levelling up. I mean, was that your impression, and should we worry about that? Does it diminish the ambition or the discipline that we may ultimately need? I mean, what was your view on that?
So I definitely agree with your interpretation that the Conservative Party conference was dominated by levelling up and to some degree net zero as well. Those were, I think, the two big themes which came out of conference. And there are obviously there's some overlap between those themes as well, as Ben Houchen kind of personifies. And I think there is a risk that levelling up becomes all things to all people. I remember vividly when I was in Downing Street, we talked a lot about the kind of just about managing people. And there was a time when, after Theresa had made the kind of original speech, every single submission from every department included a section on how that policy would benefit just about managing people. And it became a kind of joke, really. And it actually dampened our enthusiasm for talking about
the voters. Oh, no, not again, please.
Yeah, indeed. And so, I mean, I think the government, I think, is very consciously, and Michael Gove, the new Secretary of State, is very consciously trying to kind of define levelling up. Him and Neil O'Brien have talked about the kind of four key pillars of levelling up being empowering local leaders, growing the private sector, kind of improving economic opportunity, particularly through public service improvement and civic pride. Those are the big four elements of levelling up. So they're trying to, I think, create some kind of framework to make it a kind of definite agenda. And I think that's valuable. But at the same time, politically, levelling up is the kind of the main game in town. And I don't think we should underestimate the extent to which, for levelling up to be successful, it's going to require all bits of government to be driving in the same direction. And I mean, we've seen it in the last few weeks with fuel prices and kind of other factors. The government needs to make levelling up the kind of unifying mission, I think, that drives all departments, or there's a risk that kind of it's kind of going one step forward in one place.
And it's got good cut through, right? I mean, you know, we did some polling, you know, different regions, and actually, you know, you in some of these places you get, I mean, given that, on the assumption that most of the public ignore most of what, you know, government says in various ways until there's something really critical happening, you know, you're getting sort of recognition of the term and some understanding of it, over 50%, if not more, higher in some places. There's definitely a cut through to a degree that, which brings all its own challenges and, you know, and requirements and expectations, because you then have to kind of deliver.
Yes.
I want to get your view on another aspect, which is, you know, again, kind of uniform agreement that, you know, levelling up is long term by definition. And as you said, you know, we've probably been talking about it in various guises for an awful long time, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80 years, depends who you ask. We recognize that some of the problems and challenges are structural in nature, and, you know, they'll take a long time to play out. Doesn't matter when we start. So long term in outcome, but yet obviously, you know, all governments work in cycles of, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. I mean, what's your sort of insight and perspective on how to reconcile or how to bring those two things together, particularly how do you construct, you know, government programs that both talk to the short term but also have an eye to the long term? It's not easy. I mean, but you know, you were inside of government kind of thinking about these things at the time, but how, you know, what's your thought on that and how the levelling up agenda needs to evolve?
Well, if I can just start by plugging one of your brilliant events at Conservative Party Conference, Andrew, because I think your discussion with Ben Houchen really bears out this problem. So he talked, I thought, very eloquently about the need to both demonstrate short-term wins and to kind of symbolically prove progress to the electorate as you go, but also be thinking on a 10, 15, 25-year horizon. And he explicitly talked about a 25-year project, right? And he's been more successful than he hoped he might be, and it's now a kind of 12, 15-year project. But he was explicitly talking about a kind of long-term transformation, which is unusual in our political system. And I think he quite clearly actually demonstrates the kind of method that the government needs to embrace. It needs to demonstrate tangible progress before the next election, so it can say to the electorate, we have started levelling up. Last time we promised it, now we've started it, now help us finish the job. And that I think has to be the message for the next election. But the progress that needs to be made in the next few years does need to be kind of tangible and real, and not just kind of superficial improvements to place that aren't going to be sustained. So I think, I mean, from my point of view, I think the government needs to focus on a few things. They really need to focus on building the institutional capacity in some of these places. And by which I mean the kind of the ability to create your own energy and momentum and to govern your own change, rather than constantly looking up to Whitehall for funding, for kind of political capital and sponsorship, or for the kind of green light to go ahead. And so some of that's about kind of mayors and kind of devolution to combined authorities or county deals. But some of it, I think, is also much more local. It's actually, I'm a great fan of parish council, parish and town councils, for example, because I think that kind of institutional framework is really necessary for that hyper-local improvement. So that's one element. The other thing I think the government needs to think really carefully around is incentives. And Andy Haldane talks brilliantly about institutions and incentives being two of the key drivers of policy, and I largely agree with him. That at the moment, lots of the incentives for different places are actually against place-based improvement. So a classic example being the housing and planning system, where actually there's very little power for places to master plan new development and to do it in the places where we know that people are more likely to accept housing. There's also very little incentive, like there's no relationship between how much money you get for infrastructure spending, for example, and how much housing you build. And Section 106, obviously about to be reformed, but Section 106 actually doesn't really kind of generate the revenue in order to put in infrastructure to service new homes. So all of the incentives are kind of working in the wrong direction. And I think government, thinking kind of strategically and going to a high level, it needs to think about making sure that all of those incentives are driving places in the right direction and giving them not just the power, but also the kind of the encouragement and the incentive to improve their place. And those are the two kind of macro questions that I would focus on.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely spot on. You know, I was struck when, when I was talking to Ben or listening to Ben, you know, kind of reflect on this, you know, his point about the symbolic element, you can't undervalue that because, you know, in his instance, he used the airport as the example to say, you know, this was a historical problem, you know, weighed heavy on people's minds. You know, they thought of the airport as being a symbolic element of the kind of longer term decline of the place. And that's why he kind of chuck it on to deal with it. And there is a value over and above the economic value, as it were, of trying to do that. And if you can point to being able to do that in the short run, that gives you leeway then to also say, you know, over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, or whatever it might be, that we're going to really make a difference to other things that, you know, by definition will take a bit longer to come around. So it's a very good point. And you make that, you know, your point about institutions, I think, is really at the very local as well as the kind of sub-region is really important. I want to close by you're very close to Neil O'Brien. Will, you know, you co-founded Onward together. So, you know, your answer might be both the same thing. But, I mean, you're going to have a white paper, hopefully soon we'll see it. What do you want to be in it, and maybe, you know, what you expect to be in it? Maybe those two things for you are the same thing, but what are you looking forward to seeing in it?
Well, this is the point of the podcast where I either reveal my ignorance or prophetically predict everything that's
going to we'll all be listening back and listen. Was he right or not? Yeah, Did he really know what was going on or not?
Yeah. So I don't know. I should start with I don't know what's going to be in it. I'm obviously hopeful that the government has read all of Onward's reports and takes up the things that we propose. I think there is kind of one element of the levelling up debate, which I don't think has got much public attention, but has got lots of private interest within Whitehall. And that's how you can encourage private sector growth within specific places, particularly using foreign direct investment, but also through domestic private investors and companies. And if I were to hope for one thing from the Levelling Up white paper, I mean, I do hope that it has big things on devolution, on skills, on transport connectivity, but I actually think a meaningful plan with direct incentives to encourage private sector, particularly foreign direct investment, into the parts of the country which have not had that private direct investment for a long time would be really valuable. And I say that because we know there's a massive premium in terms of productivity and earnings from, especially from FDI, but also certain types of private investment, especially manufacturing. We know that there's a big R&D premium, which is an area where Golden Triangle has dominated completely and increasingly so for a long time, and we need to start to address that balance. And we also know that local leadership can make a huge difference. So the ONS experimental statistics recently showed that the only combined authority area in the country where FDI was growing faster than London was Tees Valley. Now that's because Ben Houchen is an amazing salesperson for his place and has put private sector foreign direct led investment at the heart of his strategy for Teesside. And So I think like he's kind of proven that you can do it. It's not just always going to be capital coming to London first and spreading about a bit about the regions. And so that's one area of the levelling up debate, which doesn't get a huge amount of attention, but I think could be at the core of the government's plans. And if it is so, I think that would be really, really welcome.
And in reality, as you say, you know, encouraging more and different types of private sector activity into more places is really the only way that we're going to level them up over, you know, over time and in any significant way. Public sector plays a role, but actually, unless we create the conditions for the private sector to, you know, to flourish, we're going to, you know, we'll be back here again in 10 years' time, you know, whatever it might be, right?
Exactly, exactly.
A very good way to finish. Well, thanks for being part of City Talks.
My second guest is Caris Roberts.
Caris is the Executive Director of IPPR, Institute for Public Policy Research. And before that, she was the Institute's Chief Economist. Welcome, Caris.
Hi, Andrew.
Feels like we've been talking about levelling up for a very long time. But Caris, I mean, what's been your take on the levelling up debate so far? I mean, how have you seen it evolve, I guess, over the last 18 months or so?
Well, I think up until recently, it's been quite an amorphous concept. So it's, you know, been at the forefront of the government's agenda and at the forefront of their narrative. But beyond that, the real question has been what actually is levelling up? And I think it's only recently that we've started to see a little bit more meat on the bones in terms of what that is. I think the reason that we're now seeing a little bit more is that Michael Gove has been put in charge of it. There are some other interesting appointments in terms of Andy Haldane coming in and then Neil O'Brien. And clearly, I think the government felt they needed to move forward a bit more quickly in terms of what levelling up is. So now we know that it will include local leadership, living standards, public services, pride in place. Now, those are all good things that I would definitely want to see. It's a very ambitious set. It's a very ambitious set of things to try and achieve. And it covers an awful lot of the government's agenda. And it's a bit of a 20 to 30 year project, I would say, rather than, you know, the next 1, 2, 3 years until the next general election. So even though we've got that great definition, I think the real task now is for the government to set out what it's actually going to do to try and move those things forward. How it will know if it's doing those things well, we haven't really got clear tests, and to demonstrate real progress on them, which is going to be tricky given the winter we've got coming up.
And what's your take on, you know, why is it being sort of relatively late in the day? You know, if we've got the white paper in theory coming out in a couple of weeks' time towards the end of October, why is it so late in the day, for example, that, you know, Michael Gove has been made Secretary of State, the department has been renamed, Haldane has come in as, you know, I don't know, 6 months sort of permanent secretary type position. Obviously, Neil O'Brien, who was involved before. I mean, what's your take on, you know, why we've got to where we've got to and why it's relatively late in the day that the government now is sort of reorientating itself and then giving more resource to it? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, a generous assessment would be to say that the government's had a lot on its hands. It's had the pandemic to deal with. And this isn't an easy agenda to get to grips with. It's a hugely complex agenda. It's something that multiple governments have tried to deal with. Funnily enough, this isn't actually something that's appeared in the last 2 years. And so it is a really tricky thing to get your head around. Now, my view is that the government, or at least Boris Johnson, in setting out levelling up as a priority, didn't give it the appropriate amount of attention and resource that it needed. I actually think the Chesham and Amersham election by-election probably triggered the government to think, hang on, we really need to get to grips with this, partly because of the political reasons of, you know, lots of Conservatives in the South saying, hang on, what is this levelling up? Is this going to lose me my seat in the South? And so on. And I think that caused the government to need to think more seriously. I do think there is a remaining tension, and it will be really interesting to see what happens in the spending review in relation to this, which is the Treasury and Rishi Sunak at the helm of the Treasury wanting to be that responsible Chancellor. When, I mean, I think we all know that levelling up is going to require quite a bit of investment. And I think that is a tension that has probably caused the agenda to be slowed down. And it remains to be seen whether it can be overcome.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, he was explicit in his conference speech, wasn't he, that he's a fiscal conservative, you know, but out of principle as much as anything else. And obviously, you know, he perceives the balance sheet of the country to be, you know, dangerously lopsided and would want to try and do something about that. And also your point about levelling up doesn't come or won't come cheap. I think those are all really good points. I mean, while we're in that sort of space, what's your take on kind of the Labour Party and the way that Labour is engaged with or not on levelling up? They seem to be sort of dancing around it, not quite sure how to deal with it. I mean, what's your view on that?
I think it's been a really difficult thing for Labour to respond to, because in many ways, at least rhetorically, the government has parked its tanks on Labour's lawn. You know, regional inequalities is something that was a major priority in the Blair Brown government, and that fits naturally in Labour's agenda. And it's hard for them to know whether to kind of mirror the language, set the test, go for something different. I do think it was notably not emphasised or overly emphasised in Keir Starmer's speech to Labour conference. Instead, rather than focusing on kind of the economy and productivity and so on, there was a greater emphasis on wellbeing and public services, which are, of course, important constituent parts of levelling up, but it wasn't framed in that regional inequality way. So I'd agree. I think they are sort of dancing around the issue for now. I think the big test will be as they set out their policy and their platform for the next general election over the next couple of years, will they be able to rise to the challenge that the government has set them? And will they be able to hold the government to account if they fail? And I slipped and said when there, because currently I don't think the policies are going to achieve what the government has set out. But if they do fail in achieving real change, can Labour hold them to account?
Yeah, and I think it's a great point. We did an event a couple of weeks ago with Kelly Beaver from Ipsos Mori, and you know, she was sort of saying, you know, the notion of levelling up, when the public were asked, they felt that was very much what they would expect kind of the Labour Party to have as a kind of central ethos and a central theme. And so it's somewhat interesting then that it's the Conservatives that have taken over that the term and some of the issues below, which then gives the Labour Party a bit of a quandary as to then how it responds, whether it says we'll do levelling up better, or they offer a different version or a different vision. It'd be interesting to see how that evolves, I suppose, as they begin to flesh out their policy. You touched on something else I'm going to get your views on. You know, in a sense, the levelling up agenda, even before it began to be narrowed down, and even when it's been narrowed down, is still relatively broad in nature. I mean, how do you interpret it? Is it a political short run sort of project, which is essentially about securing, safeguarding seats in, you know, relatively recently won seats? Or, you know, can you see a more ambitious economic transformation agenda, which is actually trying to grapple with issues, as you said, that, you know, the country's had for at least probably 80, 90, maybe even longer years, really? It's a long run kind of economic problem that we've had, the disparities between places. How do you kind of frame it, and how do you think it will evolve over time?
I wouldn't want to claim to be in Boris Johnson's head and completely understand his views on this, but I do suspect, I mean, he's a very skilled politician, and I think it's clear that in many ways levelling up is a political answer to a political problem or opportunity from his perspective. I do think, though, that doesn't mean that we should assume that it couldn't be a serious economic agenda. And as I mentioned, you know, there are interesting characters within the Conservative Party and from outside the Conservative Party involved in setting that agenda. In terms of where it's headed currently, though, I don't quite see that forming. Johnson, in his conference speech, was talking about, you know, shifting an entire economic model. And yet there's nothing underpinning that to actually set out how that economic model would shift. And so I don't want to kind of say that it couldn't be that transformative economic agenda, but just now I don't see that. At the moment, the the sorts of things they've been doing, whether it's kind of, you know, 1.3 billion levelling up fund, has followed the tram lines of government policy making over the last 20, 30 years, whether that's kind of, you know, small discrete pots of funding, asking local authorities to compete for it, and so on. It hasn't so far suggested that the government is ready to shift their economic model.
And if, I mean, from your perspective on IPPR's perspective, if what would you want to see in the white paper or the government's agenda on this in order for you to think, okay, yeah, maybe they are serious, maybe this is, you know, something more of a substantive agenda rather than maybe a short run, you know, responding to the circumstances as they currently are? I mean, what would you be what will you be looking out for, or what would you expect to see in order for you to take it seriously, I suppose?
So I think there are two specific things within the white paper that I would really want to see. So the first is proper investment, and for that investment not just to go, I don't say this because it's not important, it absolutely should go on infrastructure and transport and so on, but it also needs to be broader than that. So in particular, I think there needs to be investment in green industries that can create good jobs in areas that have kind of lower productivity and GVA. I think there needs to also be social investment. So physical infrastructure on its own is not going to cut it in terms of levelling up, and particularly thinking about the kind of different goals that the government has set itself. We also need to be looking at skills, at education, at health, at wellbeing, and making sure that jobs are well paid, and that's going to require investment. As an aside, Germany invested €2 trillion over 20 years in East Germany. That had some effect. It has not totally solved the problem. And so when we're talking about really small sums, it's just not even going to scratch the surface. The second thing that I'd say is that it's really important, and this is, I hope that this is reflected in Gove's priorities, it's really important that this isn't an agenda that is entirely led by and delivered by the centre. So in my view, and in IPPR's work and in IPPR North's work as well, we've always shown that actually you need to let go of some power from the centre so that places can find solutions themselves and level up themselves, rather than assuming that central government can do that. So within that, I think there needs to be clear progress on devolution, including we would ask for a devolution framework that sets out how powers will be devolved to local and subnational levels, but also a fair funding formula. So I really think we need to end this competition for small pots of money and modus operandi that the government has, and instead have proper investment matching London levels, in fact, of investment across the country through a fair and transparent formula. So those are some specific things. I think there's a kind of separate question, though, which is, you know, levelling up at its most ambitious would seek to shift the economic model that the UK operates on. It would seek to push up wages, increase good jobs, and so on. And that's going to take more than either of those things again. I think that means, and this isn't necessarily for the levelling up white paper, but in the government's economic strategy, they need to be thinking about industrial strategy, they need to be thinking about how we shift to net zero in a way that creates good jobs. And they need to be thinking about shifting real power from, you know, big bosses to workers, from the people who have wealth and assets to those who don't. And so I think there's a kind of much more transformative, ambitious agenda that could follow if they choose to take it.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with all of that. Interestingly, you referenced the 2 trillion number from, we've just done a bit of work looking at, you know, the kind of makeup of that, and done a bit of an analysis, and as you say, you know, 2 trillion over not even 30 years, it was slightly less than that. And, you know, there has definitely been progress between closing the gap between the East and the West, but which is great. I mean, in a sense, in part, it shows you it can be done, which is a good message. But nevertheless, you know, even in Germany, that I haven't finished, and it continues to be an ongoing program even after 30 years. One of the thoughts, of kind of fine thoughts around, it's interesting, I've heard the government say this quite a lot, and I wonder what your kind of take and implications are. You know, they've talked about the levelling up agenda as being for all of the UK, not just for England, I suppose, you know, seeing it as part of a kind of broader program of the government. I wonder what, you know, what your thoughts on the implications of that approach then for, you know, for levelling up, because in Scotland and in Wales, they're not, I mean, they're only really now beginning to maybe talk about it a little bit from their own perspectives. But do you think it has, what implications does it have for the programme if it's an all UK programme?
Yeah, I mean, I know this isn't quite what you're referring to, but I think there is an almost trivial point that as Johnson has felt the pressure politically, he has sought to say that levelling up is for everybody and suddenly everyone's going to be levelled up. And I think I even saw the headline that the whole world is going to level up. And just in logical terms, that doesn't make sense. So I think we should be sceptical of those claims. But on the kind of, you know, the serious point about the devolved nations, I do think this is a really interesting and important question, in that we have a very lopsided form of devolution in the UK, and we have a very lopsided form of devolution in England as well. I mean, it's like a real patchwork in terms of who has a combined authority, who has a mayor, etc., and the pathways in which those are on. So I don't know if I would say it would radically change the agenda. I think there are definitely kind of learnings that can be taken from the Scottish and Welsh experiences, in particular about what works in terms of devolution and what maybe doesn't work as well. But I do think it is, you know, any attempt to make the argument for the union, not just to people in devolved nations, but also within England, I think has to grapple with this question of how do you have proper governance in England that really hands power not just to local leaders, but also to communities and people. And yeah, so I think it's more that devolution is within England is an important constituent part of having a constitutional agreement that makes sense across those devolved nations.
Yeah, no, it's a great point again. I mean, as you know, the sort of the England question, as it's now, you know, often referred to, is not clear really in terms of where we go next on that. And I wonder whether the white paper may have something to say on that in narrow terms, maybe around sort of devolution and deals and all the rest of it, or maybe a more ambitious programme about, you know, about the way that the constitution works and the role of England within it. Maybe when we do see the white paper, we can get you back on, Karis, to see what, you know, how you thought it was and whether things that you thought might be in it are in it or not. But for now, Karis, thank you very much for being my guest.
Thanks very much for having me.
My third and final guest is Nick Bowes.
Nick is the director of Centre for London. And before that, he was the mayoral director of policy at the Greater London Authority. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you very much.
So we're going to have a bit of a chat about levelling up. First off, I mean, you know, interested in your views about the nature of the levelling up debate. You know, we've been having this debate, I suppose, for a very long time in some respects, but more particularly since this government came into power in December 2019. I mean, what's been your take on the levelling up debate so far? And then I think there's an interesting question about where London fits in all of that, but your general observations?
Well, you know, I think it's... There's part of me that's really, really finds it great that the political parties and decision makers in the country have suddenly rediscovered that the UK has got quite a complicated geography. I'm a geographer by background. I'm an economic geographer by background. That's what I did my PhD in. So, you know, I'm fascinated in the kind of why things are where they are and the kind of patterns of how that plays out across the country. We have a very rich kind of patchwork quilt geography in this country, you know, things, very hyper-localized kind of cultures and traditions and accents. I mean, I know that from my part of the country up in Yorkshire, you know, the next town speaks a totally different language to the town I grew up in. And that's just one of the most really, really amazing things about our country. But also there's big gaps between the bits of the country that are doing really well and those that are doing less well. The fact that it's actually not that new an agenda on the one hand, you know, it's not an issue, but it is a bit old wine in new bottles, in that, you know, the people have been talking about trying to deal with this problem since at least the Second World War and longer. And actually, when you look at where the areas are that are getting most of the focus and attention at the moment, they tend to be the areas that have got a lot of the focus and attention for most of that post-war period. So something's not worked during that time, because here we are still talking about a lot of the same challenges. So, and I think that you know, it plays into this kind of real sense of British fairness about you know, how people feel about levelling up, because even though it's not yet a really clearly defined concept, people broadly have a sense as to what it means, and they know that it's only right and fair that everybody in the country should have the same types of opportunities and the same chances to live a good quality of life as other areas. It shouldn't be dependent on whereabouts in the UK they live or any of the other factors. But how that then crystallises into a actual concept, you know, and what that then to in turn becomes public policy interventions is as yet to be decided. And then that's where it becomes really difficult, because as I said, we've not solved this problem. It's been around for a long time. And at the moment, it is a little bit more of a political slogan in search of a kind of policy agenda around it. And I thought what was interesting, I went to both the Labour Party and the Tory conferences, and I've never known a topic like this be like the hot topic at a party conference. Everybody was talking about levelling up. I think it was the most popular fringe event topic. I'm sure you guys contributed to that list and things that you did. And I went to a couple of small discussions with MPs and other political leaders, and everybody was talking about levelling up. And it's great. It's really fantastic. What I thought was also really interesting, and I've never heard this before, is that everybody was talking with a passion about devolution. Yeah. And with a passion about fiscal devolution, even at the Conservative Party conference, where, if I'm honest, that hasn't tended to be something that they, as a party, have been massively keen on. But the topic of conversation was there needs to be devolution, and it's got to be meaningful. It's got to be proper devolution, where there are freedoms and flexibilities for every part of the country to tailor their responses to the levelling up challenges that work for their area.
Yeah, no, I was similarly at the conferences and similarly struck as you were by the sort of pervasiveness of levelling up, and, you know, both the term but also some of the ideas behind it. I mean, what's your take on the why do you think the Conservative Party have kind of got into this sort of space in the relative, you know, in the relative past, you know, in the sense that since 19, it's been, you know, notwithstanding obviously COVID and all of that, but domestically, this has been a central theme of Johnson and Johnson's time in number 10. What's your political take on why that is?
So, I mean, look, there's no doubt about it that the primary driver for this is political. There are 70 or 80 kind of key battleground parliamentary seats that were primarily won by Boris Johnson at the 2019 election that allowed him to form, you know, the biggest parliamentary majority since 2005 and the Conservatives' biggest majority since 1987. And their route to forming that parliamentary majority relied on those seats that they won. And for the Labour Party, in turn, for them to win back power, they're going to have to win back those very same seats. So it means that there's a real focus on just a small subset of the 650 parliamentary seats. It's not the first time this has happened. It's a regular product of our system in that a lot of seats just never change hands, and there's some parliamentary seats, I think, that have never changed hands in their whole history. And I'm sure somebody will probably tweet me after this to tell me which ones they are. But, you know, so there's the whole kind of political agenda at the moment is about these battleground seats. And I think that is driving this agenda, because a lot of those seats were in the Red Wall, the so-called Red Wall, which are Midlands and Northern, mostly former industrial
seats were which are characterized as being left behind. I'm not a big fan of the phrase left behind myself, because I don't think it's the right description, but these are areas that have lost a lot of industry over many decades. They tend to score poorly on many kind of key socioeconomic measures, and they just don't share in the same prosperity that other parts of the country do. And I think that is what is primarily driving this agenda. And I'm sure we'll come on to this in time. So, but I'll just mention it. Of course, the route to that parliamentary majority for the Conservative Party doesn't really include many seats in London.
No, well, I was going to say, because in a sense, I agree with you on the political narrative that you laid out, but then that raises really interesting challenges for the position of London in the political elements, but also in the levelling up elements. And clearly, you know, London is fundamental to the economy of Britain, but as it currently looks, it's not fundamental to the political future of the Conservative Party, at least in terms of maintaining its majority. So just to unpack, I mean, what does that mean then for, you know, for London politically, and I suppose and economically, and, you know, what's your take on where London, how London has fared thus far in the levelling up agenda?
So I think it's a bit of a double whammy for London in actually, because the Conservatives' parliamentary arithmetic to achieving a majority doesn't really rely on London. In fact, you know, the one seat they lost at the 2019 election was in London. But for the Labour Party, their route to a parliamentary majority almost takes for granted the seats that they've got in London. So it means the city doesn't actually get much political interest on either side at a national level. We're in a real bind. I think then you layer on top of that the fact that it's actually a vote winner to be seen to be being quite tough on London.
Yeah.
Means that, you know, the agenda, although some of it might just be, you know, politics and people, you know, using certain language and talking a certain way, there's always that risk that it kind of hardens into a kind of public policy agenda. And then before you know it, by accident or intent, you've got quite a hostile policy landscape for London. I mean, I've seen clips of debates and ministerial questions in the House of Commons where, you know, a minister has been kind of questioned over awarding some money to something in London or something in London, and they are harangued from all sides. And I can see why ministers probably want to just try and keep their heads down on this and don't want to be seen to be, or don't want to do that much to London because it's so politically unpopular. And then the flip of it is that it's politically popular to be seen to be quite hard on London. And again, it's this product of the kind of politics of where we are. Where I think this becomes a problem is, it becomes a problem if there is a public policy agenda that you know, starts to pay less attention to the capital and its problems, and money starts getting switched away en masse. But one of the things I think we need as part of this agenda, we also just need some honesty from all sides in that we're not going to solve the levelling up problem by the next general election. I'm not naive enough to think that there isn't a political cycle. You've got to demonstrate some progress. I've worked in that arena for long enough to know that. We are not going to solve the UK's levelling up challenges by whenever the next election is, whether that's next year, 2023 or 2024. And I think we need a bit of refreshing honesty with the public that this is going to take a long time. This is going to be a national project. It's going to take decades. I mean, look, I was reading the other day about an assessment comparing our levelling up challenges to what happened in Germany post reunification, and the sheer amount of money that has been poured into East Germany, including with a special reunification tax levied on West Germany, you know, trillions. And, you know, East Germany is still broadly poorer than West Germany.
Yes.
And some areas still very poor. And you know, it puts into contrast the, you know, couple of billion pounds levelling up fund, etc., which looks quite short-termist. Where is the kind of national consensus around this being a project that everybody needs to buy into? Because, you know, we live in a pluralist democracy. At some point, there will be a change of government, but isn't this one of those kind of fundamental things that everybody agrees we need to do something about, and it continues?
Yeah, and how do you see then a sort of a rebalancing, I suppose, between, you know, the economic rationale for London and its position in the nation's economy, and a recognition that actually during COVID, London has been hit quite hard. We see all that in the data on unemployment, on furlough rates, on general closures. In a sense, London has, you know, taken a battering comparable, if not even worse, than most other places in the country. So there's a kind of economic rationale. It's a big place. It's important. It's the, you know, it's the driver of the nation's economy. And yet, as you've said, there's the political, you know, not so of interest to the current government, actually, ironically, not that interesting to the Labour Party. How does that get played out? How do we manage the rebalancing between the politics and the economics? What's your thought? You know, what are your thoughts on that?
So I think it's, I mean, this is a product of the fact that, you know, it is a complicated issue in that, you know, London's not a uniformly rich place by any means. In fact, it's got, you know, you take out the top 10% earners in London, and you know, the data is not all that different to some other major cities. But it's also got some very deep poverty. But at the same time, you're in the same breath, you're saying, but also we as a city contribute £40 billion more to the taxpayer than we get back, and we account for way more of the UK economy disproportionate to our size. Da, 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 da. It's quite hard to start talking about the two things at the same time. You know, we've got lots of our own leveling up challenges, but also, you know, we're a fantastically powerful economic kind of entity. They're quite difficult to put together. But I think there's a degree to which we've got to find a better way of talking about how, you know, London's success, particularly in the short term, really does matter to the country. It's not in London's interest that the country is as imbalanced as it is, because it means that there's an enormous amount of unproductive capacity in a kind of, you know, talk about in a kind of cold clinical way across the rest of the country that could be put to better use. But also, it's not a zero-sum game. So when the rest of the country does well, London does well, and vice versa. Mm. We lost the ability, to kind of talk about that, because people, you know, I've encountered people, friends, family, when I go back to visit my family up north, who do say, well, you know, London basically has to be poorer if we're going to be richer.
Yeah.
And of course, that's not how economies work. That's not how economies work. And I think we need some political honesty and some leadership from all of our politicians that's also not how it works. And London's success does matter. And it certainly matters in the short term, where we need quite a lot of money to help balance the books and power away in the world and pay for a levelling up agenda. And I think you also can't take London for granted in terms of continuing to fire on all cylinders. We've got very comfortable this last 30 years thinking that it's an inevitable upward trajectory for London. Even the 2008 financial crash was a mere blip to the city, actually. But there's no guarantee of that. And we know from the Second World War to the mid-1980s, London's population declined, and the whole, you know, whole areas in zone 1 to 3 in central London just hollowed out, and with cities can quickly go into a spiral of decline if you're not careful, and then we would all be poorer as a result, not just London but the whole country. And I think you sometimes don't know what you've got till it's gone. And as a relatively small country population wise in the kind of world, we punch above our weight for all sorts of reasons, one of which is we're very lucky to have one of the few, if not the preeminent global city. And lots of other people would give anything to have that. And we need to find a way of kind of instilling a little bit more. We're proud of that, actually, and also reconnect that success to the whole country.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. in terms of the Levelling Up white paper, in its narrower sense of it, you know, the publication, as it were, what would you want to see in that publication in relation to London? And then I suppose, you know, you've talked about it as well, and suppose there's a broader point about the Levelling Up agenda, which obviously will go beyond the publication per se, and London's role in it. So yep. Take the kind of immediate, what would you want to see in the paper itself or the publication? And then more broadly, how would you want London's position to evolve in the Levelling Up agenda as it undoubtedly, you know, carries on?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, as a starter, an acknowledgement that this is not got, there's no quick fixes would be really good. There's no, I'm raising expectations that this is going to be solved over the next 2 or 3 years. With the amounts of money that are being spent compared to what was spent in Germany, it's not going to massively shift the dial. So we need some honesty, I think, for starters. Secondly, I think there needs to be at the heart of this white paper devolution. It did start out originally, as you'll remember, many years ago. This white paper has been on a journey. It was a devolution white paper, then it was a devolution and local government white paper, and now it's become a Levelling Up white paper. It's almost mirrored the changing names of the departments. I think that devolution at the heart of it has to be a uniform ability of every part of the country to get devolution. I think what is a problem is when you start to have a conversation where you're asked to persuade the government to devolve to you, because it then starts to become piecemeal. Yeah. Then there's a risk that, again, they won't want to give devolution to London because it doesn't look great. I mean, what's good for Lewisham, where I live, is good for Leeds, it's good for Leicester, it's good for Liverpool. Every town and city needs to have much greater control over its own affairs. You cannot have a Levelling Up white paper that is deciding what works best from Whitehall in every part of the country. That has got to be a critical part of it. And then I think thirdly, you know, I'd like there to be an acknowledgement in it that every part of the country has Levelling Up challenges. And just as there's very rich parts of the north, there are very rich, very poor parts of London and the wider southeast, actually. And also, I think the really, really difficult thing is going to be how we shift the dial on this debate, because it's very focused on transport infrastructure. And I understand why. You know, when I go back to my hometown and I pay £2.75 for a rather shoddy bus that you don't know whether it's going to turn up or not and only runs once an hour, compared to, you know, what there is in London and the state of the rail network in the north, I get that. But it's also much more than that. And actually, there are whole aspects of Levelling Up beyond infrastructure and housing. You know, it touches on health and taxation and welfare. There's whole elements to what is a really complicated picture. And I'm hoping that Michael Gove gets that. He's at the heart of all this now, and he's going to have to pull the whole of government together to come up with an agenda that reflects that this is complicated, and each area's Levelling Up challenges are very different. The people of say Poplar, which is your kind of classic ward that gets chosen in London, which is a matter of 100 meters or so, a couple of hundred meters or so away from the Canary Wharf cluster of skyscrapers, is one of the poorest parts of the country, is a very different Levelling Up challenge to, say, Hartlepool or Rotherham or Rochdale or parts of the West Midlands. They're all very, very distinct and different, and doesn't mean they're any less important, and it doesn't mean the solution is the same in all those areas, but they all need attention.
Yeah, and as I said, you know, we're recording this before the white paper arrives, so it'll be interesting to see how much of what you've just laid out is evident in the white paper. I suppose my final question, just get your thought on it, Nick, is, you know, your level of optimism, I suppose, that, you know, the rationale for London's role and significance in the, you know, in the country at the national level and the economy, that I suppose your optimism that wins out over, you know, slightly different views, which is about doing London down and it's everywhere else. I mean, how optimistic are you in the, you know, for the next period?
So I am optimistic, but it's going to take a lot of effort. It's going to take a lot of it's going to take a number of people, to particularly politicians, to be actually quite brave in this debate. I'm not sure that you win this argument by throwing lots of data around. I'm also not sure there's a killer statistic that just, like, you know, lands London's case and suddenly everybody kind of goes, yeah, you're right, you know. I just, because I think we've got data, we've got all the data. And there's always different cuts and different takes on data, and people throw data and deploy it in arguments. Because I think if we learn one thing from the Brexit referendum, it is that a lot of people, they follow how they feel. That's a public policy nightmare in terms of how you influence and shape that. But I think we've got to respond to that. And a lot of this is about how there's a feeling of unfairness. And we've got to take that seriously and try and address that. And some of that is about making some more of the more emotional cases for, you know, why London is a great city and that we're very lucky to have it. And when Google decide they want to build their headquarters in King's Cross and, you know, spend £1 billion on a building that's the size of the Shard laid on its side or whatever the statistic is, when Google made that decision, their choice was not between London and other parts of the UK, actually. It was a choice between London and being in Frankfurt or Berlin or Paris. And if it didn't come to London, that was £1 billion that didn't come to the UK, and it was a lot of jobs that didn't come to the UK. And at the moment, there'd be quite a lot of people outside of London would say, well, yeah, so what? That's, you know, it's fine. Yeah. London deserves it. We need to find a way of talking about how that brings an enormous amount into the country that we all benefit from.
Yeah, no, that's a great message and a good challenge for all of us, and a good way to finish.
My guests today were Will Tanner, Karis Roberts and Nick Bowes. Thank you all for being part of City Talks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.